Hey, it's producer Benjamin Bombard back with another staff pick from the Radio West archives. Here's a question. How much rest do you get in a day? How much time do you take to just relax? Let your mind wander. To breathe. The thing is, you know you need to rest. But these days, there's so much pressure to stay productive, and there's just so much you need to get done in a day. Well, the scholar Alex Soo-Jung Kim Pang says that if you get enough rest, if you make it a priority, all the stuff you are able to cram into a day, you'll be better at it. You'll be smarter, more creative. You'll also probably just feel a lot better, and there's nothing wrong with that. So take some time, listen to this conversation from 2017, and then when you're done, answer this question. How much rest are you going to get in a day now?
This is Radio Westenberg Fabrizio. You know those times when you set aside your work and just sit there staring into space? It seems like your brain shuts down, doesn't it? I mean, it's not really processing anything. Well, the scholar Alex Pang says your resting brain is actually a lot more active than you might think. Pang has written a book about the relationship between work and rest, how rest isn't being idle and rest isn't passive. In fact, he says rest is work's partner. Pang says over the last few decades, these discoveries in sleep research and neuroscience and organizational behavior, sociology, among other fields, have shown that rest plays a really critical role in strengthening our brains and enabling inspiration and innovation. He makes this case for reworking the relationship between work and rest. But he says there isn't just one pattern for rest, not just one system that's going to work for everyone. He does say, though, in his book that deliberate rest, and we'll talk about what that means, deliberate rest can be adapted into anyone's life. His book is called Rest, Why You Get More Done and When You Work Less. And Alex Pang is joining us today to talk about it. He's a visiting scholar at Stanford University. His writing has appeared in Scientific American, in The Atlantic, in Slate, among others. He's also the founder of The Restful Company. This is a consulting group based on the research that he's included in his new book. And he's joining us from a studio on the campus of Stanford in Palo Alto. Alex Pang, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be with you.
I want to begin with this story you tell about a winter evening that you spent in Cambridge, England. And you were with your wife reading articles and two books in particular. One of them was Virginia Woolf. And she talks about in the book how the leisurely pace of Cambridge was one of the things that made it such a great institution. And it seems like this evening or this something converged to create a kind of an epiphany for you about rest. Would you start there, if you would?
Sure. Essentially, I stumbled on this subject by falling into it or sort of living it myself. And I had a sabbatical with my wife that we spent in Cambridge. And on this particular evening, I was reading Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, which has sort of great things to say about the importance of independence and leisure for sort of doing creative work. And a second book called Obliquity by a business professor named John Kay, who argues that really complicated things have to be approached sort of indirectly because they have a lot of moving parts and sort of a lot of uncertainty about them. And ironically, in order to do really great work, you have to do that work sometimes sort of coming in from an angle.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, this began to explain something that I was experiencing myself, which was that for the month that we had been there, I had been living a life very different from the sort of multitasking, constantly traveling Silicon Valley consultant that I had been for the past decade, but I was getting an incredible amount of stuff done. I was reading a lot, I was writing, and yet my wife and I had plenty of time to go off and sightsee and go to London and so on. And these two books made me wonder, could it be the case that people who do really good work, who are highly creative, who are very prolific, maybe they approach their lives with obliquity? Maybe it's the case that the way that they spend their leisure is actually really important for understanding what makes them creative and what makes them productive. And so sort of that evening was the sort of put in my mind this idea that maybe rest actually was important for understanding and explaining creative lives. Yeah. And that in order to do the kinds of work that many of us want to do, that that we had to learn how not to work ever harder or ever faster or on weekends, but rather sort of to rethink the relationship between work and rest and find sort of a new balance between them.
You mentioned in the book that you've had this interest in what you say is the psychology of creativity for a long mm-hmm. time now. And I wondered, what is it about that interests you? Like how it works, how we can tap into it? I mean, what is it about creativity that interests you?
Well, you know, I think there is something that is always wonderfully mysterious about it.
Right.
You know, it is, on one hand, the experience of being creative is something that we all have, that I think all humans share. You know, whether it is at the level of, sort of trying to remember who was in that movie, who was also in that play that you saw, not being able to remember their names, and then while you're doing something else, suddenly having the name come to you. Or doing much more complicated kinds of creative tasks, like writing a book or playing music or something. So on one hand, it is something that is part of our everyday lives, and yet is almost like love, has a kind of wonderful mystery and elusiveness about it. Sometimes, of course, that elusiveness is really troubling when we're not able to have good ideas or if things stay just kind of out of reach. And that is sort of the foundations for my interest in the subject. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's made it that has encouraged me is that over the last 30 or so years, there's been an explosion of research among neuroscientists and psychologists and sociologists and people in a broad variety of fields who've been exploring the subject of creativity from very different kinds of angles. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is to show how these different communities who are coming at the subject from various angles, using different tools, asking slightly different questions, how they're actually converging on a single model that helps explain how creativity works and, in particular, the role that rest plays in creative lives.
What do we think about rest as a culture? Where have we settled in the 21st century in our regard or disregard for rest?
Now, unfortunately, disregard is the much better term for it.
Yeah.
I think that, we see rest as work's adversary, mm-hmm. as something that is disposable or even a sign of weakness. And it marks a pretty remarkable change over the last few decades. There was anyone who watches Downton Abbey or other BBC shows at least has an inkling that there was a time when success meant having more leisure. And that is a vision that is almost completely gone now. In fact, there's some research that shows that the higher up the professional ladder you are, the more money you make, the more likely you are to put in long hours and to see yourself as time pressured and constantly overworked. And so I think we're in this period where busyness has become a kind of default mode for economic reasons and social and cultural reasons. And as a result, when you start a conversation with someone and you ask how they're doing, the easiest way to reply is to say, "Oh, I'm so busy." that is both, you know, a lament and to a small degree, maybe it's a little bit of, you know, yeah, a little bit of a humble brag. But one of the things that I'm trying to do in rest is to suggest that this is not actually absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
You know, that there are actually better ways of living and better ways of working.
Right. For you, this is interesting because it's about that profound question, it seems, of what does it mean to live a good life, and where work might fit in that, and where rest might fit in that. Talk about that. This is about how we get the good life, and that's an enduring question throughout human history, it seems.
It is. No, absolutely. And, you know, I think there is a strain of work extolling the virtues of leisure that see work as something for chumps, basically. And that approach is actually wrong because, first of all, some of the most valuable, most meaningful, and actually most rewarding things that we do in our lives involve challenge. They're often difficult tasks. And so I think that, you know, a vision of life that sees work as something stupid is every bit as incorrect as one that sees rest as unnecessary or stupid. And psychologists like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote that classic book Flow, I think did a really good job of explaining that the most meaningful lives are ones that are not filled just with sybaritic pleasures or, you know, sort of being on endless vacations, the sort of rich kids of Instagram vision of how you ought to live,
right,
but rather are lives in which people find work that matters to them, find work that they can be genuinely passionate about and good at, and can spend their or can devote their lives to it. And it turns out that in many of these lives, rest plays a critical role. So it's not just rest as something that is a reward for work or that is good on its own sake, though that absolutely is the case. But it's also these lives also illustrate how rest can sort of help you be more creative and more productive.
Yeah. It's an interplay, you say, between the two, that there are different kinds of rests that, here's how you put it in the book, interact with work during the course of the day and the course of life.
That's right.
They sort of work together.
Yeah. And you can see them sort of as, you know, if you imagine a wave with rest at the work at the top and rest at the bottom, you know, with any wave, you can't have the high without the low. Also, you know, those highs and lows are not opposites. They are part of the same continuum. And I think that's a valuable way of thinking about the relationship between work and rest, not as competitors, but as partners.
You talk about in the book how rest was thought about throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. The Greeks, for example, you say, they saw rest as a great gift, I think you say.
Yeah. And people who study ancient Greece and the Greek and sort of the Greek language back then find that there actually was no word for work. They described work as the absence of leisure. And, you know, what this tells us is that for the ancient Greeks, leisure really was the state that, you strove for in your life. And but leisure was not simply idleness. You know, it wasn't just, you know, hanging out under the olive groves sort of drinking wine, but rather it was the opportunity to reflect on your life, to figure out what was meaningful and to pursue that. So it was a vision of leisure that was not merely recreation, but rather sort of the pursuit of those things that would, you know, that would justify your place on this earth.
There's another part to this that I think is important, and we'll dig into this a little bit later as we go along. But the Chinese general who wrote The Art of War, this was in the 6th century BCE, and you write about this, said that it is the detached, reserved warrior who wins. And you have these other examples of people who talk about the importance of calm. So it's not just the idea of leisure. It seems like the ability to, and we'll, as I said, we'll break this down a little bit more, the ability to let your mind wander, to be calm, mm-hmm. to rest. That's also really critical.
It is, yes. You know, as you said at the top of the show, we often think of mind wandering as just your brain shutting down. But in fact, it turns out that some of the sort of busiest and most productive moments for our minds happen when we allow our minds to go off and sort of do their own thing, to work on problems on their own while we engage with other kinds of tasks. And one of the things that you see very consistently with Nobel Prize winners or novelists or composers is that they learn to rest in ways that support that mind wandering, that alternate between periods of intensive work and then sort of leisure in which they allow, in which they themselves kind of let go and do other things, but allow their minds to keep processing problems and sort of turning them over, and thereby sort of generating new insights, often more quickly than they would have if they'd kept working on them.
So you talk about how rest is active, which seems mm-hmm. counterintuitive, but you say for really creative people, the idea of rest is often more vigorous than our idea of exercise. And this was interesting how you point out active rest is like REM sleep, which is, you know, mm-hmm. REM sleep is incredibly restorative and restful, but it's also when your brain is spiky with electrical activity, you put it. So the idea of this it being active, say something about that.
Our brains are sort of almost never busier than when we're asleep. It's really sort of amazing stuff. But I think the idea of rest as being something that is strictly passive is really a very modern idea and sort of one that we have literally been sold by tourism industry and others. But if you think about rest as the time spent restoring the mental and physical energy that you spend while working, what turns out is that you get the biggest bang for your buck not just by sitting on the couch and binge watching the latest, you know, or of season of whatever. Right. Though there are times when that's good, and you know, sort of the only bad rest really is the rest that you don't take. But of the most restorative kinds of rest turn out to be active. Things, you know, simple things like going for walks or exercise. These provide a greater sort of recharge than simply doing nothing at all. And when you look at the way in which creative people in the past rested, it often turns out that they, you know, went on like 20-mile long walks, which is something that Charles Dickens did virtually every day. You know, dressed in Victorian clothes and with those boots. So that was like, you know, running a marathon every day. But, you know, I think his track record stands for itself.
Alex Peng is with us. His book is Rest: Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
It's interesting we think about this idea of rest, thinking about it as being a modern thing, but you talk about Santiago Ramon and Cajal, who a Spanish neuroscientist, one of the founders of neuroscience, in 1897, making this argument, advice that he gives to young scientists, that if a scientist chooses to be prolific, to be frantic, as he put it, that person, they close themselves off to the possibility of discoveries and great work. This is what you call the problem of rest in the book. Talk a little bit about this, if you would.
Sure. And Ramón y Cajal was one of the sort of people who sort of, discovered brain cells and neurons, and he did really fundamental work in neuroscience in the early 20th century. And one of the things that he observed was that some of his colleagues were incredibly prolific, and more prolific than he was, but their work was not as deep. You know, and that basically you could make a choice as a scientist or as any kind of creative person between putting in really long hours and turning out lots of stuff or having really good ideas. Now, Ramon y Cajal himself had what seems to us like a pretty amazing track record, right? A Nobel Prize, plenty of papers. But this is also a guy who was a dedicated painter and amateur photographer. He's also someone who had, a favorite cafe where he would go and hang out in the afternoons. And so he was someone who really practiced what he preached. And he was very conscious of needing periods in his day where, he would get out of the laboratory and give his mind a rest. But he also recognized that it was in those periods when all kinds of subconscious processes were going on, ones that scientists now have begun to examine and understand, that generated some of the some of his best ideas. Mm. One of his contemporaries, a mathematician named Henri Poincaré, actually said that his subconscious mind was the better mathematician than he was, because it was able to come up with solutions to problems that he himself, no matter how hard he tried, couldn't figure out. And yet, when he was, let's say, walking on the beach in Normandy or on a hike someplace, sometimes his subconscious would suddenly produce the answer to a problem that he'd been struggling over for months. And I think that their examples show how important it is for creative people to work in downtime into their schedules so that they can kind of nudge their creative subconscious to produce these kinds of moments and have the opportunity to generate these kinds of insights and ahas.
You write in the book that there haven't always been these boundaries between work and rest. We used to be better at kind of getting the things together. And you also say there's an intellectual component to this, that it used to be that philosophers would say, look, reason alone is never enough. You need contemplation. You need meditation. So rest was seen as really critical for culture. We're not anywhere near that right now, it doesn't seem.
No, it's something that we've done a really good job of forgetting. And part of what's happened is that we've become much more suspicious of intuition for all kinds of both philosophical and practical reasons. Mm. Intuition isn't something that you can, command or put on a schedule. Yeah. And so, it feels more reliable to try and work your way through problems than to wait for insights. The other thing I think is that we've tended to think of insight and creativity as so unpredictable that we can't build them into our schedules.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way that that this is the divine spark that strikes some and not others, that does so almost at random. Mm-hmm. Who wants to rely on that?
Right.
But it turns out that I think that gigantic discoveries do have that kind of feeling of randomness about them, but it's also turns out that the smaller versions of creativity, the solutions to everyday problems or incremental steps in things that you're working on, those actually are kinds of problems that we can not exactly outsource to our subconscious or order our creative subconscious to work on, but we can learn ways to kind of tempt our subconscious to keep working on them on our behalf. Mm. And this is I think what explains both the daily schedules of you know, people as different as Charles Darwin and sort of Scott Adams, but also, you know, explains why they got so much done.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to both of those people. A lot of fascinating thinkers, and as you say, had completely different routines in many ways. But the fact is they had a kind of consistency to them. Let's come back to Ramón y Cajal, because he came up with a solution, you say, for people who waste their energy on too much overwork. And his idea was this cultivation of cerebral polarization, sustained concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that is.
So the simple way of explaining it is to get completely immersed in a problem, you know, that to reach that level of or to focus on a subject so that it becomes almost something that you start dreaming about.
Right.
You know, Cajal was working on problems that often involved dealing with, you know, large amounts of data and sort of competing theories. He had these were problems that required juggling an awful lot of parts. It's actually not too different from the way that, you know, architects talk about their work, or, you know, software engineers describe programming. But he said that, you know, you had to reach that state of cerebral polarization sort of in order to, in a sense, kind of fill your mind and prepare it for insight. And then the next thing that you did was, having reached that stage, to kind of ease back and then to allow your subconscious time to process this and to work on it on your behalf. And in order to do that, there were various things that you could do in order to encourage that.
Let's talk about the science of all of this, science of rest.
Sure.
There's a grad student at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Bharat Biswal, that you write about, was the first really to, one of the first anyway, to measure the brain in a resting state. And it's ironic, he was attacked for it. Talk a little bit about this. Explain what's going on in our brains when we're at rest. I mean, as I said earlier, you'd think that our brains would quiet down, but that's in fact not what's happening.
No. So in the 80s and early 90s, or neuroscientists came up with a technology, fMRI, that allows them to study what's going on in the brain in real time by measuring what parts of the brain are consuming oxygen. And in order to see where or what parts of the brain were active and how active they were, it would be useful to have a baseline of the brain at rest, right? But when Biswal and other people trying to calibrate these machines had people just think about nothing, what they saw was not a brain that shut down, but rather the appearance of a second network, what they called the default mode network, which it turned out was consuming every bit as much energy as sort of our brains when we're doing calculus problems or something else that's really challenging. And they realized, first of all, that there was actually never a point in our waking lives when our brains were inactive.
Right.
But second, that the default mode network had a few interesting properties, one of which was that it seemed to be structured for creative thinking. There were sort of parts of the brain that sort of serve as filters or editors that, you know, keep us from sort of saying the first thing that comes to our minds. And that's a kind of circuit that is cut out in the default mode network. And so the default mode network is better at sort of exploring a wide range of what look like crazy ideas, also selecting ones that seem plausible and sort of calling them to our conscious mind's attention. This seems to be what happens when we have those, you know, moments of insight or aha moments. It's the default mode network continuing to ask, okay, you know, who was it who was in that movie who was also in that play? And then producing an answer. So it turns out that sort of the neuroscience on sort of the resting brain connects with the neuroscience or the psychology of creativity at sort of the level of the default mode network and mind wandering.
So when your mind is wandering, when you stop thinking about the task at hand necessarily and you start going somewhere else, you engage that default mode network, and then there's this greater level of communication going on between the regions. You're starting to think of different things. And so more options become available to you, I guess.
That's right. Yes. So, you know, I mean, I think it's worth noting that this doesn't happen for things that we don't know anything about.
Right.
Right. Or if it
we just can't magically conjure something. Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, I will never come up with an insight on or of medieval Chinese poetry because I don't know poetry and I don't read Chinese.
Right.
The biggest insights come when you've been or engaged in that cerebral polarization, when you've been working really hard on a problem. It's a bit like the role that rest or recovery days play for professional athletes, right? Or if one of the things that that world-class athletes or world-class trainers have recognized in the last couple decades is that you can schedule rest days and recovery time, and people actually learn new moves more quickly. They get stronger, or they avoid injury. And so they have figured out that learning how to rest in the right way, to rest deliberately as athletes, is a really valuable thing. And, you know, there's a parallel here that learning how to sort of to give mind wandering, to give the default mode network time to operate under the right conditions is every bit as valuable for creative people.
So can we train ourselves for this?
Yes, we can. Every person listening to this show has already, done fairly amazing cognitive tasks, right? We've learned language, for example, without having anyone sit down and teach us nouns and verbs. We picked it up as, we picked it up as children. And, you know, I think we can, and likewise, we can learn the ways to nudge our creative minds, to our creative subconscious, into sort of working on problems in our absence. Or sort of absence of our conscious thinking. One of the things we know is that the default mode, that the wandering mind actually really likes having things to focus on. The negative version of that is those periods when we reflect on the bad things that could happen to us or the mistakes we've made. That's the negative version of mind wandering. The positive version, though, is the one that comes when we've been working really hard on a project or an advertising campaign or something else. We're able to structure our days so that not only do we do the work that the kind of visible work that that is necessary for everybody, but we also give space to our subconscious, to our wandering minds, to look over these problems, to review these fields, and sort of to make their own contributions. And often we're able to get much farther if we're able to do that than just by trying to power through it. Now, how long does it take to learn this? For some people, most people go through early phases where they work really hard and then they have some kind of epiphany or of moment where they almost burn out and they learn to kind of scale back and learn deliberate rest. It is something that sometimes takes years to learn. I don't think it has to. And people, when they stumble upon it accidentally, take longer, not surprisingly. But I think that, that sort of people who change up their schedules, for example, and start working in or of naps or daily walks, report certainly improvements in their mood and improvements in their energy level immediately. And I think that it takes maybe a couple months for your creative mind to realize, hang on, I've got this time now. I can get busy in these periods and sort of do some interesting things. So, yes, it is something that we can learn. It takes a little while, but it is something I think that everyone can learn and everyone can benefit from.
I was really taken by how many great artists and writers and scientists and thinkers really only worked 4 hours every day. Let's talk about this section in the book, the 4 hours. And maybe you could talk about Charles Darwin and John Lubbock. They're kind of great figures to illustrate all of this.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the most striking things that I found when I was doing the research was how consistently people across a variety of fields worked really intensively for 4 or 5 hours every day. And that was it. You know, if Charles Darwin was a young professor now, he would get fired because it would look like he wasn't working hard enough. And Darwin had a next door neighbor, a guy named John Lubbock, who was a banker and was also a member of parliament and or was a noted insectologist. He actually was the guy who invented the ant farm. Yeah, the two of them were very, very different. Darwin was very introverted. Lubbock was, you know, was your kind of classic extrovert politician, banker, and so on. But the two of them still had schedules when they were sort of out in the country that converged around these serious 4 hours. And Darwin himself would get up very early in the morning, have a walk, then lock himself in his study. After breakfast, he'd work for a couple hours really hard, then take a break, go back for a couple more hours, and literally in mid-sentence sometimes when he was working on a manuscript, would declare himself done for the day, and then he would go out for a long walk on a piece of land that he actually leased from John Lubbock, and upon which he had built what he called his thinking path, which was a kind of sandy path with trees on one side that looked out on a field on the other. And this was Darwin's day. And in those 4 hours, he was able to write, you know, The Origin of Species and The Descent of Man and, you know, more than a dozen other books. But that pattern of 4 hours, often broken up by a break in the middle, is something that you see in field after field. And in fact, in the class, there's a classic study of deliberate practice by a Florida sociologist named Anders Ericsson. And this was a study of conservatory students in Berlin. So these are, you know, kids who are like 18, 19, 20 years old. And he found that the really outstanding students practiced differently than the average students. And they practiced more intensively, but for shorter periods.
Right.
And they also had very clear objectives when they were working and a couple other things that set them apart. But the most notable thing was that they practiced for about 4 hours a day with or broken into two-hour periods. And so it seems that there is something about the day or the human body that converges around this number. And so this is why, you know, I think writers, when they have a 4-hour day, actually feel really good about it.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is one of the things that sort of we struggle with in office jobs and other kinds of day jobs. Having longer days than perhaps we would if we were starting with a blank sheet of paper. But ironically also, even within an 8-hour day, with all of the distractions of email and smartphones and other technologies and open offices, finding the time to actually focus for that long a period. But, you know, if we can, that turns out to be a spectacularly useful thing for us.
Yeah. Ericsson's study, this was interesting. I thought the top performers in Ericsson's study actually slept about an hour a day more than average performers.
Mm-hmm.
Should we scoot over to sleep and talk about that?
Sure.
We'll jump over the morning routine, which I don't want to skip entirely, but how important is sleep?
You know, sleep is the original deliberate rest. And I think there are countless studies that show that both in the short run and in the long run, sleep deficits affect performance. Ironically, they also affect your ability to know that your performance is degraded.
Yeah.
So there's you kind of take a double hit there. But there are also plenty of indications that sort of chronic sleep deprivation over years is implicated in all kinds of chronic diseases. And so both for companies and for individuals, this is actually a really serious problem. The other thing that we've discovered is that your brain is actually doing an awful lot of stuff when you sleep. The brain consists of neurons and synapses and the things that get a lot of attention. But there's also a kind of scaffolding system consisting of what they call glial cells. Mm-hmm. And when we sleep, the glial cells get really active and do things like clear toxins out of our brains. And so when we don't get enough sleep, we prevent our brains from engaging in the kind of physiological maintenance and repair work that helps keep our, that literally helps keep our brains healthy. So, you know, plus sleep feels really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, this gets us to morning routine actually. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Scott Adams, who writes the Dilbert comic strip, for example.
Yeah.
He has a morning routine. And it gets me thinking about, is morning better than other times? It seems like for a lot of us that it's perfect for me. I can really focus in the morning. But then there are night owls who seem perfectly creative. I mean, how does the sort of the circadian rhythm work in terms of our focus, and how important is morning for that routine?
Right. So it really depends on whether you are naturally a morning person or a night person. And counterintuitively, if you are more of a night owl, you'll be more creative if you get up in the super early morning. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I've discovered myself, you know, through most of college and graduate school. You know, I would start work on, you know, papers at 11 o'clock at night and finish at 3. Mm-hmm. When I was writing my last book, though, I realized that I couldn't possibly sustain that kind of schedule with a job and kids and so on. And so I flipped the day and started getting up at about 5 a.m. And at first it was really hard dragging myself out of bed. But then I found that sort of there were that the benefits were that, first of all, I was not going to self-distract, right? If I'm up that early, I'm not social. I'm not going to check Twitter. Nobody else is awake. So all of those distractions were pushed to the side. But I also found that it was almost like the door to my subconscious was kind of left ajar in those really early morning hours. And so as sleep pressure was easing, as I was becoming more awake, I had this period where I could be super productive and have really terrific ideas before everybody else got up. And this is something that lots of people discover. Now, if you are naturally an early morning person, ironically, staying up later may give you more of a creative charge, but I think it's worth experimenting to figure out which one you are and, you know, learning how to play with your schedule to your creative benefit.
We don't have time to get to all of these. Exercise seems self-evident,
right,
as being really important. We were already talking about sleep, maybe, but we need to say something about naps. How important is a nap?
You know, naps are not just for kids, you know, little kids on yoga mats. Naps are, you know, a good nap, which can be, you know, just 20 minutes long, is surprisingly restorative. And it can also be sort of a period where your mind has an opportunity to kind of let itself go and to come up, you know, sort of to come up with ideas even while you're resting. So, and I think a growing number of companies are recognizing the virtue of naps and sort of trying to install things like sleep pods or spaces where their employees have an opportunity to sort of to rest up.
What do you mean by deep play? Deep play is really important. I love this part.
Yeah. A shocking number of really ambitious, driven people have serious hobbies.
Right.
And this is kind of a mystery because, you know, when you're competing for Nobel Prize, why would you do something like take 4 months off and go climb Mount Everest?
Right.
Well, it turns out that that there is a connection between of creative work and this kind of leisure. What it does is, first of all, serious hobbies provide a really nice cognitive break from your work. Winston Churchill loved painting, for example, because working with paints was very different from passing legislation or governing. At the same time, these are hobbies that offer some of the same kinds of satisfactions as the work that you love without the frustrations. So for Churchill, painting was, he said, like politics, because you literally needed a clear vision. You had to know where you wanted to go, what you wanted to say. But, you know, when he was painting, he didn't have the Labor Party standing over his shoulder saying that barn is the wrong color and the sky has more clouds. And finally, there's an autobiographical component to it. Lots of people will sort of choose hobbies that that connect with their past in some way. And so for all of these reasons, deep play provides both a break from one's regular work, but also a reminder of its most rewarding parts. And in a way, kind of rebuilds enthusiasm or resilience, particularly for people who work in fields where you might have to make a lot of compromises, or fields where you may work for years in order to pass a great piece of legislation or make a great discovery. For all of those reasons, it turns out that deep play is actually really important for creative lives.
You make an important point at the end of the book that a lot of us assume the most creative people are young. But you did this tally of geniuses, and you say you found that many of them lived well into their 80s, and many of them, most of them, were usually really active until the end of their lives. What does that tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that there are geniuses who die young. That's the romantic vision of the way that genius works. But the people who learn to practice deliberate rest get two big kinds of benefits. First of all, the deliberate rest sort of stimulates creative days. It helps you be more innovative with the problem you're working on right now. But it also turns out to sustain creative lives, by which I mean it gives a kind of measured pace to the work that you do and the way that you do it that helps you avoid burnout, that allows you sometimes to develop entire second careers after you've retired from your original profession, and thereby allows you to stay creative for for sort of a longer span of often a longer life. So Darwin, he finished his last piece of research just a couple months before his death. And in the population that I study, he is not at all unusual. We have lots of people who work into their 80s or 90s and are productive and healthy right up to the end, which is, I think, a great model.
Yeah. Well, there are other things that you can learn by reading Alex Pang's book, Rest, about the importance of taking a walk. We mentioned naps, but also stopping and exercising and sabbaticals. Again, the book is Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. Alex Pang joined us from a studio on the campus of Stanford University. Alex, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.